Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Guys, welcome back to Talk Magic. This is episode 3, and I am here with an absolute legend, and I do not use that word lightly, an absolute legend of coin magic, Dr. Michael Rubenstein. Honestly, it is a real honor having you on the show, Mike. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, everybody who's watching this knows all about you, but obviously you are, I like to think of you as almost like the godfather of modern coin magic. It's you that's been the driving force behind a lot of the coin magic that we see nowadays. And what I'd like to do, first of all, is just talk to you a little bit about that, because I mean, you've released so much magic over the years. You've released standalone items, books, DVDs, just a plethora of magic. So I bet, do you even know how many coin routines you've created at this point?
I actually don't. In my book, which I have right here.
Brilliant book, by the way.
I have like over 100 routines of my own in there. I didn't put all my material in because, you know, over the years, and I think it's important for anybody to do this, as you do your magic, over the years, you get better. You know, you learn other things, and periodically, I always revisit my routines to see what new things I can incorporate into them and how I can make them better. So there's a lot of older handlings, which I decided, you know, I just didn't think should go into the book if I have a better handling. A lot of times I'll watch myself and I'll see maybe an abnormal finger movement, which I then try to eliminate. Sometimes it's hard to know until you actually watch yourself. So watching yourself, you can be your own best critic. So if you choose to do that, you know, you could actually make your magic better. There are a lot of routines that I just haven't done for many years. And I felt that, you know, look, let's just leave those to the side. Let's work on the newer stuff. You know, I've been doing coin magic, I guess, for the public really since the early 80s. And there's a lot of magic that, you know, magic has changed a lot, you know, since the early 80s. I mean, when you think about when David Roth came out, you know, a lot of his stuff was table magic, classic sit down, beautiful routines. But then I guess, like, you know, right after Michael Lamar won FISM in 82, he did a worldwide tour and he really promoted stand up walk around magic, which really was important for many professionals who did table hopping, you know, worked in restaurants, parties, things that you do. Yeah. I think that the stand up magic really took precedent, and a lot of my older routines were sit down table formal routines. And I just felt, well, although I thought they were good and they had merit, I felt that the newer stuff really should be in the book. So although I still have some sit down table routines in the book, most of my material is geared toward the stand up walk around performer.
Having said that, you pioneered something which I think was revolutionary for stand up magicians, and something I still use all the time, which is your matting system. Because I do trade shows and I do bunco booths. And for me, that was a game changer, because it allowed me to be able to do stuff that would normally require lapping in a situation where I didn't have to sit down. And when I first saw that, I was like, this is just genius.
Well, thank you. It came about basically, I'll tell you why. I was in a competition in the early 80s, and I had decided I was going to use the toppet because I felt, you know, I'm going to be doing a stand-up routine, and I missed the toppet. Now, nobody saw it. I did. It went down to the floor, but nobody saw the coin flash or anything. And I actually won the competition. But, you know, when you drop something once, you get scared. And, you know, I just decided there's got to be a better way. And that's how I came up with the matting idea. And then the idea of using a two mat system was because a lot of times if you're performing in a restaurant or for friends or whatever, you know, the table may not have had a tablecloth. And if you're sneaking things under your close up pad and you don't have a tablecloth underneath, then you're going to get noise. So I came up with the idea of the two mat system, where I had a red mat on a black background, because I felt that the black background acted more like a stage and the red mat was the platform on which you work. So it made sense. And that's what I used for many, many years. I used to actually have a black pad on, that was part of a box, and I just carried the box around, put it down, put the other mat on top of it, and I was good to go.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's such a great idea. Here's a question for you. How did you get into coin magic? Like, how did you get into magic, period? Was it like you decided to do? Because I've never seen anything that you've done that's not coin magic. Obviously, in your new book, you've got stuff that involves a pack of cards, and so I know that you do stuff with cards because I've read those routines, and I can see that you know a pack of cards, you know. But how did your name become synonymous with coin magic?
Well, when I was about 9 years old, my aunt went to a very popular magic store in Macy's in New York called Macy's, and there was a little magic counter, and she bought me a Svengali deck and the Linking Rings. I was in the fourth grade at the time, and you know, I took the Svengali deck to my fourth grade talent show, and I showed everybody the cards. And I said, "See, they're all different, and they were all aces of spades." And they went, "Oh, wait, okay." And I did, "See, they're all different, and they were all aces of spades." And I realized, you know, you probably should read the instructions before you perform a trick in public. So that kind of ended my career right then. But then when I was 15 years old, I took a trip with a bunch of other teenagers across country, and we camped out and we went in a bus. And one of the people on that trip was somebody who worked at Al Flosso's magic shop in Manhattan. And he showed me, I don't even remember the exact trick he showed me, but he showed me a trick, a coin trick. And I tried to learn it, and I learned it incorrectly. And in doing so, I came up with what I thought was, well, I didn't know at the time, but he told me it was an original sleight. It was angle palm, which is where it's held in the crotch of your thumb. It's got a lot of names because a lot of people have come up with it over the years. And in fact, on the Encyclopedia of Coin Sleights, I called it angle palm to try and not give credit to any one person, like Drobina or Jack Shannon or Lamont Ream or Ed Michel, who actually, when I sent him some material to MUM in the 70s, he told me that he did that same palm, but he didn't publish it because the material was too complicated for the readers. But I called it angle palm. And then in thinking about it and thinking about the ways magic has been named and changed over the years, like the cap subtlety is now the Mellini subtlety because people wanted to get proper credit. So the earliest reference I could find to that technique, and I'm sorry to go on a little bit out on a tangent.
Please do. I love this.
In 1941, I think he put out a book, Handle with Gloves, and he used that and he called it the JC palm. So in order to, since that was the earliest reference I could find, but yet it seems like so many people came up with it. And some people told me even that Ramsey did something similar when he couldn't classic palm anymore. I couldn't find an exact reference, but you know, I don't doubt that there may be something out there. So I decided to call the concealment in my book angle parentheses JC palm, because I felt that he should at least get credit for being the earliest to date, and maybe something else will come up and they'll find out that, you know, in 1852 somebody in France was using it. I'm sure that there's a lot of people who probably experimented and maybe used it, and you know, back then the books didn't really show all the material. So I felt that that was probably the best way to keep the name that people became familiar with on the Encyclopedia of Coin Sleights, yet give credit to the originator. So that's why I call it that in my book. But when he saw what I had done, back to the story, he was very, very impressed because he had never seen that before, and said, "Listen, you got to get this book, the Bobo book." And so my birthday was coming up. I had my parents give me $15. I went down to Al Flosso's magic shop in Manhattan. Disgusting store. There was old crappy stuff all over the place. There was an old counter, and he comes from the back, and I tell him what I want, and he was thrilled. So not only did he sell me the book, he spent the afternoon showing me magic from the book, and that hooked me. I just, you know, became a big coin magic fan, and I did everything in the book. And this is another good story. So I guess I was about 17, I went to school in Syracuse, New York. There's a university there. Came in during the break, and I come into the store what was his name? It's Bob Elliott. It's funny, he's a good friend, but as the years go by. Anyway, he came to the counter and said, you know, what kind of stuff do you do? I said, I do coin magic. He goes, well, how much do you know? And I said, I know everything. And I'm actually writing a book. And he goes, oh, really? Show me something. And I tried to do stuff, and everything I did was terrible. It just didn't work. And he just said to me very nicely, he was very nice, said, listen, why don't you come back to the store on Saturday? There's this kid you should see. His name is David Roth, and he does coin magic. So I felt really bad. My ego went from like this big to like that big. And, you know, that's a good lesson in itself. You know, never try and, you know, overinflate yourself. So I went back and I watched David and I went, oh my God, his stuff looks brilliant compared to what I was doing. And then I said to myself, I've got to change the way I'm doing magic. So I, you know, went back home and, you know, redid everything. The earlier stuff was out in my book, Intermediate and Advanced Coin Technique. There are some good ideas in there, but that was really my first attempt. And there were a lot of typos because I didn't know that they weren't going to edit the book. They just took it and printed the manuscript. So, you know, wasn't that happy with it, but it was my first book and gave me some exposure. But I redid all my magic, and that's kind of how you could see that was like my early material. And then my material changed to become more retention-like. And while I appreciated what David was doing, I felt that retention magic should really be brought to the fingers, which resulted in a lot of my fingertip techniques.
That's great. And talking about David, I mean, personally, in my opinion, if we were going to make a Mount Rushmore of coin magicians, it would be you, Latta, Gallo, and Roth, obviously. And you bought out a ridiculous amount of DVDs, which pretty much covers all of coin magic. What was it like being on the East Coast? Because that's always been kind of synonymous with excellent coin magic, being around those guys. And how did that set of DVDs come about?
Sure. So first of all, New York had just so many great magicians, and they used to all meet Saturday in this deli. So it had changed a couple of places, but basically there was this deli that everyone went to. And I would come back from college and I'd have the summer to go every Saturday. And at this place, you know, you had Harry Lorraine soliciting everyone for things for Apocalypse, and sitting at the table with him was Gene Mays and Ken Krenzel, great card guys. And then you had another table where you had like Jonathan Townsend, David Regal, David Roth would come in occasionally. Lotto was always there. Mike Gallo was working in New York, but I never saw him at the deli, although I'm sure he was there. Saul Stone was there. So there were a lot of great magicians, and everybody was always eager to help and, you know, give their opinion on what you're doing. So it was really a good way to learn. And I remember showing something to Sam Schwartz that I came up with, a great card magician. And he said to me that Di Vernon had already done that, but I should be proud of myself because at my age, I came up with that, and he, you know, did it when he was like 50. So that made me feel good. I think he was just trying to make me feel better, but it did make me feel good. And, you know, you learn that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, everybody who did something before us, you know, can teach you something. And that was a good lesson. And I got to tell you, back then I was kind of in awe of David, still am, but you know, I wouldn't sit at the table with him and Lotta, and Kaufman was there. I wouldn't sit at that table at all. And finally, after I developed some of my newer techniques, I sat down with them and I showed them some of my stuff. And David invited me to his house for a session. And he'll never let me forget this, that I brought these cookies called Rugula. And he still remembers that. And we sat at his table in his apartment, and he did nothing. And it was basically like an hour audition for him. I just did all these tricks. And that's kind of how we became friends. So let's fast forward now to 2003. There was a, I think it was the Long Island Invitation or Long Beach. I'm not sure. It was a big convention out west in California. And it was organized by Danny Archer, Curtis Cam, and Reed McClintock. And they decided to tack on a one-day coin convention, which they called the Coinvention, onto that, maybe it was Las Vegas seminar, something like that. Anyway, they tacked it onto that convention. And so there were like 100 coin magicians there. That's where I met Mickey Silver, who was doing the stuff out of his face for the first time and, you know, wowed everybody. And I thought it was a great idea to have something just for coins. And by that time, I had gotten to know Jeff and I got to know David. And we were talking, and I just said, you know, this is such a great idea. Why don't we do this in New York? I mean, we got us three, and Jeff and I were special guests at that convention because we really hadn't been around very much. But I said, let's do something in New York. So we organized the first New York Coin Magic Seminar. It was supposed to go 8 hours. It went 12 plus. We did it in a hotel in Midtown Manhattan. We only had 8 participants, and we hired Mike Gallo to come in to be the special guest. And he was just so fantastic. That after that, we just said, look, you know, he's a New York guy. I mean, he was working at Tannen's, and that's how we all knew him. And I said, let's just make him part of the group. So he became part of the group. And then we did the second one. We went back to to I think the Las Vegas seminar, and we just did our group, but we had Curtis Kam as a special guest. And we repeated that in the third seminar, Mark D'Souza's Magic Theater. Curtis wasn't our guest, but we had Kainoa Harbottle. And because we did it at Mark D'Souza's, it was his house, he had a basement where he has a full theater with tiered seating and a beautiful stage, and he had the material for filming. You know, we just decided we'll film it. We didn't know what we were planning on making this great series of DVDs, but we filmed it, and it turned out we were able to make a two-disc DVD set, you know, that was just on Coins Across, and that was the theme of our seminar. And it was only about 20-something people, but it was very intimate. You know, the big drawing point, I think, was having a pizza lunch. Everybody, you know, magicians love pizza. So we had that. And then we did workshops. So we had all the participants break up, and they'd sit at different tables with us, and we'd rotate the tables. And so they got to do more intimate stuff. And it was just 2 days of, you know, fun, asking questions, showing magic, very informal. The second day was filming the DVD, and whoever wanted to stay and watch could stay and watch. And so that was just so successful. We had such a fun time. And Mark was so willing and so generous that we just kept doing it at his place. And each time we had a seminar, we had another special guest. And sometimes there were other magicians who wanted to come. We had Tim Conover come just to hang out with us and do magic. He didn't want to be filmed, but he, you know, showed us his cylinder and coins and taught some beautiful things. And the guests are like a who's who in coin magic. I mean, we had Al Schneider. We had... there are so many, I'm going to forget a bunch of names, but we had Scotty York coming in. We had, let's see who was on there, Eric DeCamps. We had Doug Brewer. Eric Jones participated. We brought in Giacomo Bertini from Italy. That was his first U.S. appearance. We brought in Jean-Emmanuel Francais from France. Scott Robinson came by as a friend of Mike's, and he did some stuff. Just so many magicians, and I'm sorry I can't remember all their names, but they're on the DVDs.
That's amazing. It's such a resource for people to learn from. It really is. So with all of the material that you've created over the years, and like I say, it's a ridiculous amount, what is your 1,000 timer? You know, if you meet somebody for the first time and they go, oh, show me a trick, what's that thing that you kind of... what's your go-to effect?
Different effects for different things. I mean, one of the effects that I always carry with me is, and it's one that you actually performed on one of your videos, is my copper, silver, brass routine.
I love that.
That's been over several changes over time, because there was always something that I just wasn't 100% happy with, so I just kept tweaking it. But I love that routine. It's modular, so you know, you can do one or two moves, you can do five, or you could even extend it and do a show with just three coins. So I love that. I don't do one coin routines, you know, but I have a purse that carries four coins, and I can do some of the go-to routines I do. I do coins across. I mean, I have several different versions, but one that's easy just with three coins is Tallahassee jumping coins. That's in the book. And then for me, and this is very, very important, you know, I talked about stand up, walk around magic. I think that's very, very important for professionals. But one of the things that most magicians aren't professionals. And where do they do their magic? They're sitting with friends or family at the table. And after dinner, they're asked to, you know, oh, you're a magician, do something. So I always have something that it's my go-to effect for doing magic, sitting down at the table, and I'll show it to you.
I'd love to. Yes, please.
So I've got four coins here. There, they've got substance, they've got mass, they're silver, they're beautiful coins. But I'm going to show you something that I don't usually show people. I've got it right here too. It's a little tiny hole, which I'm going to place at the center of the table. Now you can't see it. And you can't feel it either, but I'm going to prove to you it's there, not by its physical qualities, but by its metaphysical characteristics. And I'm going to demonstrate using 1, 2, 3, 4 $1.50 just going to place at the center of the table. This hand goes underneath, and with a little push, I can make one of those coins actually travel right through the table, right here, and into the hand below. So that leaves me these coins that haven't gone through yet. We'll hold them over here. And I'll take this one and I'll put this one underneath with a little push right about there. The next one goes right through the table. That leaves, of course, two coins just sitting here looking pretty, and these two coins haven't done anything. So these go underneath, and with a little push, the third coin, just like that, goes right through the table. Well, that leaves just one coin. We take these three, put these under with a little push. That last one goes right through.
That is exceptional. That is just beautiful, beautiful magic.
Thank you. So this is a routine that I've been doing in some form or another since I was 17 years old. I was taught the original coins through the table by Tony Econ, who was actually a pretty clever card magician. And not to change the subject, but I used to do everything close up. I used to do cards, coins, sponge bowls. I did everything, ropes. And then, I ended up graduating from vet school, got married, had children, and I had to stop pretty much everything. And then when I decided to get back into magic, when I had the time, I decided to just focus on coin magic because that was my strength, and that's pretty much why I do that. But aside from that, just getting back to the story. So I learned coins through the table, and I remember some years ago, I was talking to David Roth. We were in a restaurant, and I was saying, I always try and revisit my magic, but this is one routine I've been doing since I was 17 years old, and I love it. It fools everybody. It's my favorite effect, and it was the coins through the table, but it was the original version I had learned from Tony Econ. And as I'm doing the routine, I'm thinking, oh my God, this cries out for improvement. So I set about trying to figure out how I can do a routine that is done at the center of the table, not at the edge of the table, because most magicians, you'll see an obvious slapping move. I guess I can say that magicians are saying this, right? So I tried to set it about so that, the hands always appear to be here, not here. And that's what this accomplishes. So I think it's a very clean way of putting it through the table. And this is kind of what I'm talking about. When you're doing magic for friends sitting down at a table, you're with them. You're not standing up and performing for them. When you're sitting down, you see my head, my hands, the coins, everything's like in a box. If I stand up, you have to look down and up and down and up and down and up. So, it's like a tennis match. So I think that sit-down magic, there's a place for it. And I think that for most amateur magicians, there's certainly a reason to learn these kinds of routines. I have routines for doing this stand up when I don't have the ability to do it sit down, and they're in the book as well. But I think that, just because I love this so much. See if you can see this. So I'm gonna take the coins, watch that spot. This hand goes over here. One hand goes underneath, boom. Just like that, they all go right through.
That's great.
That's something in the book as well.
That's great. My gosh. Well, you touched on something there. We have a lot of people on this channel asking two questions, which you are the absolute perfect person to ask. The first is, how do they get into coin magic? Because let's be honest, you know this as well as me. A lot of people don't do coin magic because it is more difficult than card magic. There's instant gratification with card tricks, but with coin magic, that's not the case. But how would you advise somebody who's been doing magic for a while to get into coin magic? And then secondly, the other question is, we have a lot of hobbyists. I did a Q&A just Sunday, and several people asked the question, as a hobbyist, where do I get an opportunity to perform? Now, you're obviously not a hobbyist, but you juggle magic with a career. You obviously have a career as a veterinarian as well. How do you find opportunities to perform whilst having a full-time job?
Good question. Obviously, my story may be a little different. I never considered myself a full-time professional because veterinary medicine is my primary line of work. Well, I had to retire recently because of health issues, which I'm doing well, though, by the way. But I unfortunately can't work with animals because of the risk of biting and infection and that kind of stuff. When I, graduated, I realized, this is going to be my primary profession. It takes up a lot of time. And so the coin magic for me was more for enjoyment, for friends, relatives, that kind of thing. And because while I was in school, I went to school in Italy, and I had the time to perform and lecture, because I did competitions, I met people who invited me to lecture, and I was able to take the time while I was in Europe to do those lectures. I went to Japan, I went through Europe, and that's actually when I filmed the, it was called the Master Coin Technique Series in Germany, but they became the Encyclopedia of Coin Slides that you were referring to, because L&L bought the rights went to Hands-On at Videotics, and then they went to L&L. So, but I was able to film them in Germany. So I actually got more well-known in Europe than I was in the United States at the time, and I got known in the United States basically because of my book. And there was a couple of conventions that were took place actually from a few years in New York, the New York Magic Symposium, where all the top guys in at least the United States, if not the world, I don't remember all the performers, but they would go there. It was a great convention, and you got to meet and get to know a lot of the other magicians. And so I worked, you know, during the year, and then on my vacation time, I went to conventions and I lectured. I never did restaurant magic. A little bit when I was in Italy, and I did street magic during the summers when I was in school on the streets of Fifth Avenue in Manhattan and at the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I actually wrote a book on street magic called Inside Street Magic, a small little pamphlet, but it was the only thing that was out. Came out in 1985. Some people still can find copies in the used bookstores, but kind of told you how to go about doing it. A lot more material now on street magic, which now is, I guess, called busking. But I think that was one of the earliest books that talked about it. So I didn't really have the time to go out performing for parties and, you know, weddings and things like that. And I would perform mostly for magicians, as I said, at the conventions. And, you know, it was nice when I was able to perform at the Magic Castle. I performed there in 1986. I got to spend the week with Di Verna, which was just an amazing week. You know, he came to every single one of my close-up shows, sat with me, you know, we talked about magic a lot. That was like a great thrill. And then I never got back because of my work until like 2017, I think I was there. So just, you know, for me, magic was always there as, I hate to say it, a second profession, just because the veterinary medicine just took up so much of my time. But I think I'm very fortunate that I was able to do both. Oh, and absolutely. I had to meet you at Blackpool one year.
Oh, that was the highlight of that Blackpool and then some. It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing that I finally got to meet you. Mm-hmm. And how would you what advice would you give people that want to get into coin magic? Is there a book that they should read or a trick that, you know, I've had so many people say, what trick should I learn to get into coin magic? And it's not really about learning a trick, but, you know, if anybody can give some advice on this subject, you can.
So my feeling is, I mean, most of the magicians of my generation started with Bobo. And, you know, Bobo is a great book for fundamentals. And there are some really good tricks in there. There's a series of tricks with handkerchiefs that I still do to this day. I modified it. It's in the book, actually. Copper or silver extraction.
I read it the other day. So your version of silver extraction, copper silver extraction.
Yeah.
I read it in the book because I've done that for years. And I somehow missed it when I read through the book. And I was reading it literally the other night. And I was like, this is so much better. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
That is that if, you know, the standard silver extraction is you finish with a plastic disc. And once people see it's a plastic disc, they think that's cute, but they obviously know you switched the coin. So the idea was to use a plastic disc in a way that they wouldn't think it was a plastic disc. So that was the idea of that trick. You know, I didn't want to give them the time to examine it and look, but I wanted them to see the illusion of the silver leaving the coin and then going back into the coin. But the trick I'm talking to you about, it's copper silver extraction, copper penetration, and then there's a transposition that I put on at the end of it. And the first two tricks really are right out of Bobo. I just modified it to use JW grip, and that really made it look a lot more clean. Tricks like that were in Bobo, coins to the tables in Bobo, coins across is in Bobo. You know, there's some great tricks in Bobo. So, and plus, I think they really taught the concealments well. I think the reason people are scared of coin magic is because of the concealments, primarily classic palm. David Roth says that classic palm is like having a sixth finger, and it really is. I use it a little less than I used to, only because my hands are very dry now. And when I'm performing impromptu, I don't have time to put some spray on it and rub it and make my hands a little more sticky. So some of my magic really doesn't, it changed a little bit to reflect the change of use of classic palm to some of the other positions. But, you know, that's the hard part for people. People don't want to practice. But I always say, you know, if you're going to practice a sleight, you know, you got to really practice it. Keep the coin in classic palm, you know, drive your car, you know, walk in the street. You got to develop the muscles. And I love the line, and I keep quoting my friend David Roth, but he says, you know, he's got these two muscles over here that, you know, a lot of the Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't have those muscles, but he does because of just developing it over time. JW grip, nowhere palm, finger palm, even thumb palm. You know, you just keep the coins there until you're comfortable with it. You develop the muscle memory, and that's really how you learn coin magic. I think that the nice thing about magic today is that people have the opportunity to look at DVDs and downloads, which we didn't have in my day. The Encyclopedia of Coin Slides, I think, is an excellent resource for people who want to learn moves. Let's face it, you know, a trick is made up of moves. It's what you do with the moves that makes them important, but you have to know what to do with the coin. So before you, you know, before you learn to run, you got to learn to walk. So you should learn the moves. In the Encyclopedia of Coin Slides, I think after learning the basic concealments, really helps to learn not just maybe one type of shuttle pass, but a few different shuttle passes. Maybe not one type of click pass, but a few different click passes. Maybe not a changeover pawn, but a few different changeover pawns, because your hands are never going to always be in the exact same position, and the coins are never going to be in the exact same position. And if you don't learn different ways of doing things with the coins, you're going to be limited in the actions that you take. For example, and I know you know this, you know, the ROPS move. The idea of the ROPS move came about because whenever you do a retention pass, you have to start by taking the coin in one hand and putting it in the other. But a lot of times the coin's already in here. And if you want to do a vanish, a lot of people will do this, you know, and then that. And that's an extra move. So if the coin is here already and you can make it go out of the hand, you know, then you should.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to go completely selfish right now. The ROPS move is my kryptonite. It's the one thing that I have literally never made look good. Have you got any advice that you could give me and anyone else on the ROPS move right now? Because I think it's the move that's synonymous with your name. It's such an amazing... It stops that whole thing of, let me put the coin in this hand, now let me put it back into this hand. It cleans so many routines up. So if there's any advice, oh my gosh, that'd be great.
So it's interesting that you say that, because I've been doing this since the 80s. And when I look back at when I performed when I was younger, I was always very fast. And that's one of the things that you learn as you do magic. You got to slow it down, because when you work too fast, I have a quote in my book, actually. It's something like, if you do your magic smooth and slow, the magic will always flow. But if you hesitate while moving fast, the illusion of magic just won't last. And the reason I say that is because if you're working really fast and then you got to do something and you hesitate, people see that hesitation. But if you're doing it very slow, they'll miss it if you like don't get it exactly right. You know, like you're, you know, trying to steal the coin out and you stop here. They're going to say, oh, wait, something's going on there. So the slower you do the magic, the more magical it looks. And I used to do magic as working at a vet in a practice where people would come supposedly every 15 minutes, but they'd be shoved in every 10 minutes. And you had to really talk like this and had to say, okay, what's wrong with your dog? What's going on here? Let me take a look. And, you know, you're talking really fast. And so that's the way I used to practice. And that's the way I used to actually perform. And when I get excited, I tend to do that too. So it's a conscious effort to slow down. But I did the ROPS move fast, and I could do it fast. But looking back on it, it was very forced. You know, instead of, you know, just saying, instead of saying you have a coin there, you know, I'd say, you know, look at that coin, but I'd touch it really fast. And I felt the faster you did it, the better at the time. And I remember I went on a lecture tour and I went to Nice. And usually I practice a lot before the tour, but I was very, very busy with my practice. And I didn't have that much time. And I figured, okay, these are things I do all the time. I'll practice on the plane. I'll practice, you know, by the time you finish a lecture tour anyway, your stuff is really tight. But, you know, it was like the first stop. And I guess I didn't do the move well. I don't know. The lecture was going fine. I did the move and somebody got up and said, I do not like this move. And I went, okay, I'm sorry. You know, but he insisted, I do not like this move. Anyway, then came the break, and he and like 20 of his friends got up and they just left because they did not like the move. So I said to myself, it couldn't have been that bad. But I went home and I like spent the entire night practicing my timing, because timing is the essential part of this. The finger movement is the same. It's the same as this. It's Al Schneider's snapback technique. And I just applied it to a retention pass and I applied it to the ROPS move. But it's the timing. You know, you have to make sure that, you know, when you're getting the coin out of your hand, you're doing it at the moment when your hand is closing. And the idea is, you know, it looks like you're tapping the coin twice, but the second tap is only implied. You're stealing the coin during the second tap, but the idea is that nobody sees it. So it looks like you're just going, okay, I have one more coin here. And you know, you're taking it out during that time. So the timing is very, very important. And I think I put a lot of tips in the book that I hadn't really ever discuss because I know where people make their mistakes. But slowing it down is very important. I still see people who try and do it really fast, and that messes things up. Or they hit it three times. I think that's too much. Anyway, I think that it's something that that if you just practice really slow to start, you know, without showing the secret move, you know, if you practice it really slow, you'll see that it works a lot better and it's a lot easier and more secure.
That's great.
There are a lot of things you can do with the rocks move, though. You know, like, you know, you can do, well, what I do a lot of times is, you know, I'll do a click pass. This is a double click pass. And this is a funny story. So Reed McClintock learned his coin magic from my Encyclopedia of Coin Slides. And I met him and he's telling me that, you know, and I had a double click pass that used a little piece of Funtac so the coins would be attached. And I taught that, but he actually figured out a way to do it without the Funtac. And I never thought of that because I thought it would be impossible. But I looked at it and I went, geez, that's really great. And it's basically it's the same technique. He just applied it to what I should have done, and he did it. And it's now one of my favorite click passes. It's in the book with his name there. He was very nice enough to let me include it after all these years. You know, just great technique.
It is. There's so many applications for it. Here's a question. I don't want to keep laboring the point, but you've got so many creations that you've done. Do you ever perform other people's material? On the channel, I put a video up every single day at 6 o'clock.
I don't know how you do it.
Neither do I, to be honest. It's a lot of reading and practicing, to be honest. But the other day I put a Jeff Latta routine, the 3-coin routine, off.
That's his best routine, and I'm so glad you did it. I loved your take on it.
Oh, thanks so much. I love it. But the first time I saw him do it was on your DVD, and I was just like, this is amazing. This is just such an amazing routine. This fits my style perfectly. But I don't think, I love magic so much, especially coin magic. I could never be in a situation where, even if I created 1,000 routines, no, I'm never going to perform Roth's Portable Hole. I'm never going to perform Michael Rubenstein's 3-coin routine. Have we frozen?
I'm here.
Oh, are you here? I thought my screen froze for a minute. Hang on, I'll edit that back in. Yeah, I couldn't be in a situation where I'm not performing other creators' material. So I just wondered, where do you sit with that?
Sure, I think it's great to perform other people's material, but I think that it's always good to make it your own. Like I saw even when you did my Copper Silver Brass, you know, you put in some of your moves and things that you're comfortable with, and that's what magic is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be being Slidini. That's the problem with DVDs. I think that when people watch a person perform on a DVD, and I say this in the introduction to my book, you know, you tend to mimic the performer. And you know, I'll give you an example. Kainoa Harbottle, Giacomo Bertini are people that have very specific flights. Lorenz Godon has a very specific, they all have specific styles. And if you do it exactly the way they do, you're just imitating them. I think that you take what you learn from them and you make it your own. You have your own abilities and, you know, things that you've learned over the years, and you can modify them. You don't have to do everything exactly, unless, of course, you see something you like better that you want to learn. So it's fun to do other people's routines. I used to do more other people's routines. And as I watched and played with the routines, they kind of changed, and I put in my own personality, those crazy puns, you know, that's just me. I really am like that. Which is, as I said, well, I don't have a lot of friends. My wife stays with me through thick and thin. So I actually once went to a comedy show. I said, I'd like to perform stand-up. They said, you can stand up and leave. So that was my career. But anyway, by the way, there was this great, you know, speaking, we talked earlier about the pandemic. There was this great movie on Netflix that says something we have in the States. I don't know if you have it in England, where this giant insect creature comes down to Earth and sneaks up behind this lady, who turns around, looks at him and goes, 6 feet. Anyway, just had a fun one. So the pun thing is just basically me, and I incorporated it into my magic because if I look like I'm enjoying the magic, I think the audience enjoys it, and they get that they're stupid jokes. They really do. You know, I don't profess to be a great comedian, but I even say during when I perform for the public, like when I performed one of my coins across routines that's in the book, I say a lot of these puns, and I go, I don't go for the laugh, I go for the groan. The bigger the better. That's why I perform for grown-ups. And And, you know, they get that it's a groaner, it's a silly joke, and they begin to laugh, not at me, but with me, because they get the idea. And so that's why I incorporate it into my magic. But I don't expect other people to do the jokes the same way. You can do all your magic straight. You know, I don't expect everybody to do every routine with my moves, because, as I said, you know, moves are usually personal to the performer. I think my magic is a little more broad-reaching rather than specific styles. Like I mentioned, Godone's, Bertini, and Harbottle, who have very specific styles that work great for them. And I think that you should be able to pick and choose from each performer, find out what works for you, and incorporate that. And that's what I want you to do with my book,
Rubenstein. Available now from Michael Rubenstein. It's amazing. It's such a great book. And I want to talk more about the book in a second. But what you just said leads on to a perfect question I have for you. One of the things that I notice when you perform is it's very well scripted. It's thought out. It's not put and take magic. I'm going to put this here, now take this, now put this here, now take this here. And I think the best thing to personify that is your Penn and Teller act, the Twilight Zone, which is just, you can tell that you're a fan of the Twilight Zone, and you brought that into the presentation, and it was beautiful. I was engaged watching that before you even started doing any magic. It was just like, it was like listening to a storyteller. So can you give any advice on scripting, you know, because...
Sure. So what I do is I come up with a trick, and you know, the trick itself is fine, but you know, what do you say? Do you do a play by play? I'm going to take the coin and put it in this hand and it's gone, and then it appears over here, and then you know, play by play is fine, but I don't think that it holds the attention as well as a story. Now, not every story is the same, but I usually, you know, outside of the jokes, I usually talk about maybe something that happened to me, something that my audience can relate to. That trick that you just mentioned is about the Twilight Zone, and a lot of people know the Twilight Zone, so it's a hook. I think that if you can give a good hook, people become more invested in your act, and if they become invested in your act, they're going to enjoy it more. So I think that that's very important. And I come up with a trick, and then I play with it. And it takes a while. You know, sometimes the story changes. Sometimes I come up with an idea and I throw it out because I just don't like the story. So before I get to the point where I'm actually showing it to anybody, you know, I'm thinking about what can I say? What would be funny? What would make this trick engaging to an audience? And so I just start talking out loud, and I'll start writing down some ideas on the computer. And then you have to put it together. So what I do is I talk out loud when I walk my dog. Now, people may think I'm crazy, but now they can't see it because I got the mask on when I'm outside. But, you know, I'm there mumbling, you know, the dog doesn't care. He already knows my tricks, so dog doesn't pay attention. But that's what I do, and that's how I get it to be smooth. I actually recorded some things recently for showing people what was in the book, and you're welcome to put one of those up if you like that. And those are, you know, scripted out purposely for to show people what you can do. They're not always, I don't think I have every single presentation in the book, although I have a lot of my own original presentations there. You know, sometimes people just have to figure out their own ways. That's what I did. I thought about it, rehearsed it, practiced it, and then I had to incorporate it with the moves. Now, the thing about the Penn and Teller spot, and I'm glad you brought that up because that's a story. So I heard about, you know, the Penn and Teller show early on. I used to go to a dinner several times a year with all the top magician guys in New York to Alan Greenberg's house. He was the CEO of Bear Stearns, and he was also part of Kaufman and Greenberg Publishing. A super wealthy guy, but he was like a regular guy. And it was wonderful. There were all the magicians. David Blaine was there, David Roth. Different people would come in and out if they were guests in the city. A lot of guys that maybe were not well known in terms of names around the world, but people that were well known in New York, whoever was around. Jamie Swiss would come. Michael, I can't remember his last name, he's the head of Monday Night Magic in New York. He would be there. And, you know, whenever anybody, as I said, would show up, there was Apollo, and who did he work with? I'm sorry, I'm blanking on names, but you know, they'd come in periodically and be there. So Stephen Cohn, the Millionaire's Magician, would be there all the time. Simon Lovell, the news in New York, he was there all the time. A lot of great guys. Anyway, it was just Eric DeCamps. We just sit around, have a nice dinner, chit chat, and do magic. And Mary Aided was there, and he was talking about how there was this show by Penn and Teller, and they were looking for magicians to do tricks, and the idea was to fool them. And I thought it was a stupid idea at the time. I said, you do a sleight of hand trick, and all they have to do is say sleight of hand, and they win. So I just didn't think about it. And then I saw Eric Jones go on, and I saw David Roth go on, and I said, you know, I could do this. Why not? I've never really been on national TV. It sounds like fun. So I sent in a bunch of my tricks with all the corny jokes, and they were promptly rejected. And I thought that the jokes were good, but I thought that the magic would fool them. So finally, after like two seasons of sending in stuff, I said, okay, I'll send in some other tricks. And I sent in my Twilight Zone Wildcoin, which the pattern was very, very different because it lasted maybe a minute and a half to do the trick. You know, I didn't really say all the stuff that I said on the show, but they liked it. And I actually said to them, I have a longer version because I knew you had to be about 5 minutes. So if you like this, I can send you the longer version. They immediately wrote back saying, we want to see this. So I came up with the patter over a weekend, the genesis of the routine. And I sent to them and they liked it and they wanted me to do it. Now, I knew it wouldn't fool them because it was basically a standard Wildcoin plot. David Roth had done it two seasons before on Penn and Teller. So it's not like the guys didn't know the basic workings of the trick. But the idea was that they really liked the story and they wanted me to present the story. So I you know, had to work it out. I had a few months to tweak it and everything. And I worked really hard on thinking about it. When you're doing the show, and I talked a lot to Paul Gertner, they have 9 cameras around the studio and they're shooting you from every angle. So you don't really know where they're shooting you. And I figured I don't want to get burnt doing anything angly, which I thought might be better visually, but you know, you have to be practical. And I think a lot of magic should be practical. You see a lot of people on YouTube doing stuff, which you know is only because the camera's right there. And if somebody was over here, they'd see it. If they were over here, they'd see it. You can't do that on Penn and Teller because you don't know what's going to show up. The producers make that decision. So I tried to make the moves as practical as possible, yet really try and show my hands empty. And so that took a while. I worked a lot with, you know, I sent in to Mike Gallo, to Mark D'Souza. I said, what do you guys think of, you know, using this sequence? And I got their feedback. And I had to be really careful with the script because as Paul Gertner says, when you're on TV, you know, if you don't get into the magic right away, people get bored and they change the channel. So you have to make sure that what you're doing is right. But the funny thing was I shortened it and I really tightened it up. And then they called me and they said, we want to add an introduction for you. So I'm thinking, okay, they're going to make it longer. That's interesting. And what they did was I got there and they filmed that video introduction where you see like what looked like the Twilight Zone, which I couldn't call the Twilight Zone because of, I guess, liability issues. So they had to call it the Fool Us Zone. So they put in this thing. I had 3 days to learn the general script that they gave to me that would go with the filming. So I did that. And so it actually had the introduction to the show. It had the Rod Serling introduction. Then it had the trick. So it was kind of like a progression. So I had to change my routine for two reasons. Number one, I felt, well, if I'm gonna have any chance of fooling them, I gotta put in a technique that they don't know. And I figured, okay, maybe the matting they wouldn't know and that would fool them because the rest of it, even if they didn't know the moves, it doesn't matter. You know, you can do the greatest move in the world that may fool them, but if they know the gist of the trick that, you know, you're switching coins, that's the thing. And they make it very clear. They don't want you to care about fooling them. They want you to put on a good show, which makes sense because it's TV. So I kind of bought into that, but I still wanted to fool them with something. So I added the matting technique. And then when I got to the rehearsals, they said, you know, you have to do it sitting down because the table's too low. So I said, well, it's a stand-up trick. So they moved the table up to like about here. And the matting move that I usually do is for a hand that's, you know, standing up like this. This is a natural thing, but like this is not going to work. So I had to come up with a different matting technique or go back to the old way I was doing it, which I think is a good way, but I didn't think it would give me a chance to quote unquote win. Because you always still want to do that, even if they tell you not to worry about it. But they got it. Now I noticed on post-production, there was a little flash, the coin caught a studio light, but you know, they're supposed to look at all the camera angles and choose the best ones because it's, you know, the show's not seen for months after you perform, and they should have they want to make you look good. So they should have a beautiful sequence without any flashes or strange things being seen. And they must have missed it. So, you know, I got some flack on that, but you know, what are you going to do? I thought the routine came out great. And, you know, afterwards, they were really nice. The people took me off stage and they put me in a hallway and just stuck me there. And I had no idea why I was there. And then all of a sudden Penn and Teller, I guess on a break, come through the door and they shook my hand and they said how much they liked the routine. So that was nice. I didn't get a chance to ask them, you know, how did they know that I was Matting the Coin? At the end, that was I still don't know. Did they see a flash? Did they just know my technique? I don't know. I want to find out. If they're watching this, let me know.
Teller is very well read. You know, he is a very studious guy. He might have studied your material. I mean, maybe, possibly. It, you know, I know he's into coin magic, so there's a good chance that he might have, you know. But yeah, I don't know. Wow.
They're both very nice, though. It was a great experience. I loved it. And, you know, even though I didn't fool them, the whole thing, they were top notch from top to bottom. You know, I got there, they put you up in a nice hotel. You know, they help you, they cover the cost of your meals. You go with them for a day to film the pre-production part, which actually is a lot of fun. You're with these guys, and they took me to a veterinary hospital, and I did some stuff there. And they took me to a golf course in Las Vegas that was based on the Twilight Zone to film some of the sequences. And they spent the whole day, you know, they asked me a ton of questions and they edited it out into a really tight little, you know, 30-second spot, which I really liked to this day.
That's great. Well, on the back of the Penn and Teller thing, I have another question for you. One question that we get on this channel an awful lot. People want to know how to deal with nerves as a magician, shaky hands and that sort of thing, because as a coin magician, shaky hands and nerves are the worst thing that you can get. You can kind of get away with it a bit with cards, but with coins, you're in trouble. And through this interview, you've talked a couple of times, and I'm thinking, so Penn and Teller, I would be petrified to go. I would do it, but I'd be sorry. But even way back when you said, oh, you wouldn't sit there, you know, just the thought of sitting down at a table with you, Gallo, and Roth, and then just taking some coins out and going, right, guys, let me show you a coin trick. I would just melt into a puddle if I was put onto a table with you three and I had to do a coin trick. I would just literally dissolve into a puddle right there. So you've put yourself in a lot of really stressful situations. How do you deal with nerves?
I think that's a really good question. And talking about the Penn and Teller spot, you know, my first time on national TV, didn't know how it was going to go over. Didn't know what to expect. You know, you could ask everybody who's been on the show several times certain questions, but you don't know. So my wife and I decided to get tickets for this filming the day before I was due to go on. I actually got tickets for every single day, but I didn't know what day I was going to be on. So the day before I was going to be on, we went. And while I was there, I won't say who it was, you know, some guy did a trick and like after like 20 seconds, the whole thing blew up and they had him do it over. And I went, oh, you can do it over. I didn't know that. And then Allison, you know, she flubbed the line and they made her do it over. And I went, oh, that's not bad. You mess up, you do it over. So that takes away a lot of nerves. But I think that the real thing that helps prevent you from being nervous, and this is for anything that you do with magic, not just being on TV, is you have to know your magic really well. In my book, I have a lot of quotes, as you know, and one of them is, you know, what gives you confidence is the ability to do the magic without fear of failure. That is, do it so well that, you know, you can do it in your sleep. When I did the patter, the moves in the patter in that trick have to be precisely equal. I mean, it's a scripted thing. Every move is justified based on what I'm saying. And that's because the script is to a T. You know, you have to say all the exact words, you know, the inflections and all that. And I practiced it till I could do it in my sleep. So I didn't have to worry about anything when I was performing. You know, I was focusing on looking and watching the reactions of Penn and Teller. So I'm thinking about that as I'm reciting. I'm not thinking about the words. If you have to think about doing a difficult move, then you're not thinking about what's going on with your audience. And that's where you're going to mess up. So if you're nervous about that, it's going to show in your magic. You have to be able to be confident enough to perform without failure and to be able to do it in your sleep. And that's what makes the nerves go away.
That's great advice. That's awesome advice. Now, I want to talk to you about your book in a second. But before I do, could you show us a routine out of the book?
Well, you get a good picture of Angie there.
There she is. So
we've got one, two, three, four coins. So I have to think about this for a minute. So now if I take the first coin and I just tap my wrist like this, the first coin goes. Now, of course, you can see the coins, you can hear the coins, but if I just wave them like this, the next one goes. That leaves me two coins. Now, if you keep your eye on this one, you'll miss this one vanish, which just leaves me one coin. Okay, now you got to keep your eye on the coin, because if I go like this, that one goes. But they never go too far, because I can find one right over here. And I can find another one right over there in the air. Of course, if there's one there, there's a third one right over here. And of course, I have a fourth one right over there. But it's an illusion, because they're all gone. Where do they go? Back in the purse. Just a quick little thing.
That's awesome. That's just so magical.
Thank you.
That is so magical. And that's, you know, that's the perfect example of, and I'm, you know, you can achieve so much without a gaff. Like I'm 99% sure there was no gaffes in that. And that brings me up to a question. Do you use gaffes very often? I know you've got a section in the book on gaffes.
I call myself a purist, and it's not because I don't like gaff coins. When I was younger, I had a copper silver coin and never really used a shell. And I just felt, you know, unless a gaff will help you to make your magic better, if you can do the same thing with sleight of hand, why bother? So I never really invested in all the gaff coins, you know, the flippers and stuff like that. I had a folding coin when I was younger, you know, didn't really do much with it. I got a flipper, the rubber band broke, and I just kind of put it to the side. And I just felt, you know, the nice thing about sleight of hand is you can do anything. If a gaffed coin can make the routine better, no problem. But I just didn't feel that I needed it. And I felt that that was the focus of my book, should be sleight of hand, not things that you had to buy expensive props for. I do have a chapter with gaffed coins, and some of the contributors to my book gave me routines with gaff coins, but they're usually the common gaffs that most people have. Things like cigarette through the coin, or I use a trick with a signed dollar bill through a coin. You know, you need to have a flat coin, but those are specifics. The silver extraction clear disc is, you know, a little different. The blank coins are a little different, but the general gaffs that people use, the shell, the copper silver, you know, I don't really use that much.
I find that when you use a gimmick, it's specific to a trick. Like you know, Ronald Davis, I believe, who is a great gaff maker. He's
great worker.
He's amazing, isn't he? He's currently making me up a gaff for one of your routines, like your book. The one where it's in the copper, silver, brass section. I don't want to say what it is, because you know the where you. Yeah, you know what I mean. I'm not going to go any further, but he's currently, I said to him, do you know Michael Rubenstein? He said, yeah, I know him really well. I'm like, great. Have you got his book? Yes, I have. Right. This is the page. This is the writer. Make me this. And he's like, yeah, no problem. I can do that for you. But the point I'm trying to make here is you couldn't accomplish that trick without using that gimmick, but it doesn't have a use anywhere else. It's like something that you put together specifically to accomplish the effect that you were trying to accomplish. Is that right? So it's like a means to an end.
If I use a gaff if I feel it's going to enhance the routine. So there aren't too many in my book, but certainly I think that if you're going to do magic, you should have access to everything in the magic repertoire that you can, you know, help to make your magic better. So I do use them. I don't use them very much, but sure.
And you know what? I recently learned your routine fusion, which I'm going to be reviewing on the show in the next week or two. That is just amazing. It is such a clever, it's not really a gaff, really, it's not. But, you know, the routine where, you know, for those people that don't know it, the whole idea is that you borrow a penny, you borrow a quarter or a coin, and you literally push the one coin into the other coin. It's amazing. It's such a magical thing, especially the way that you've structured it.
Very visual.
How did that come about, if you don't mind me asking?
So when I was living in Italy, before the euro was about, they were using lira. And there was a 50 lira coin that was just a silver coin. And then they came out with a 200 lira coin, which was the same size that was the 50 lira. It was silver on the outside and the center had a gold center. And I said, you know, there's magic here. So I had a local machinist cut out the gold piece for me so I can show the 50 lira piece and the gold piece and put them together. And then I got the 200 lira piece. So that was a cool trick. And then, you know, when I came back to the States, I decided to market it, which I did for a little while, through Tannins with a quarter and a penny. And I made the gimmick through Sasco, which they actually had it. Somebody in I believe 1980 named Jay Howard came out with a routine that was very, very basic, but it was the same idea. So I just embellished the routine and they made the coins for me and I sold my routine. And then, you know, it was really only for a limited time to be sold commercially through Tannins. And then I just basically had the coins myself and I used to sell it at my lectures. And then I kind of stopped marketing it. A few people came out with similar things. There was a guy, and I can't recall his name, in England that came out with a routine that used a different gimmick, but it was the same idea. And I told him about mine and he agreed that he wouldn't make his routine available in the States so that we would have some separation. Jay Sankey came out with the same coin, but a different routine. And I showed him that I was selling it at my lecture, so he stopped selling it. And, you know, over the years, I basically stopped marketing it because I wasn't lecturing as much and it wasn't a good item since I had so many other newer items to discuss. So I just kind of stopped carrying it, but it's a great routine. I think that the penetration of the penny into the quarter or half dollar is very visual. I mean, you just see it on top and you just kind of right in front of the eyes and it's together. It's a wonderful routine. You can carry it around and I felt it should be in the book, even though people maybe don't have access to that gap, but they can make it up. You know, it's not a difficult gimmick. And if you go to any of the coin workers and say, this is what I want, they'll make it up for you.
Yeah, it's great. It's the sort of thing that Paul Harris would have said, a real moment of strange, you know, it's kind of like, what? It just doesn't make any sense.
What's even nicer is the way you visually make the penny fall out of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hand everything out. So it's really clean.
It's beautiful. So let's talk about your book. Where can people buy it from? Because obviously it is available in dealers, but it would be easier and better to get it off you because I got mine copied directly from you. And obviously you can sign it that way and you can get people to sign copy.
That's a good question. It came out on June 8th and it sold out before its official release date. So with books, it's interesting because when I was young, you know, books were basically the only way to learn magic. And an initial run of a book would be about 2,000 copies. And then as time went on, I was told, well, now people are only printing 1,000. So when it came to making this, I asked advice for a lot of people because believe it or not, nobody wanted to publish it. So everybody who did, first I wanted someone to write it for me because I was working. And then when I got sick and I had to leave work and I was in isolation wearing a mask before it was a thing. So I was home and I figured out, okay, I've been wanting to do this book. Nobody wants to write it for me. I'll write it myself, which turned out to be a godsend because I was able to put in improved handlings of things that, you know, when I really watched some of the routines, I said, you know, I really don't like that piece there. I'm going to change it. I'm going to tweak it. So a lot of the things that I did in the New York Coin Magic Seminar, which I thought were really good at the time, you know, in reviewing it, I said, I got to fix that little spot there. Or I think I can make it a little better or more visual here. So I was able to put improved handlings into the book. And there was a lot of unpublished stuff that I had never really shown around. And had somebody written the book, they would never have seen that stuff. So I was able to put a lot of the unpublished stuff into the book. So I was very happy about that. And then I couldn't get anybody to publish it because every single one of the coin publish or the coin book, or magic book publishers, they were all filled with projects. So every single person was too busy. And I finally, you know, was able to find somebody who could do the layout for me and I wrote it myself and got them to the layout and I published it myself. So I was told that now they only make like 500 books at a time. So I decided I'll make 600, you know, this way it'll last a little while. Sold out really fast. I reprinted it, sold out again, who knew? And I've actually reprinted it a third time and the book just came back from the printer. I distribute them through Murphy's. So Murphy's has distributed out. So anybody who doesn't have it is going to get it any day now. So the book's going to be available worldwide again. So if you don't have it, I recommend you get it. It's really heavy. During the pandemic, I didn't have weight. So I just used this, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, going. it does carry a lot of weight, this book. But it's got, you know, if you don't mind me saying, it's got over 50 original techniques, over 100 of my own routines. It's got 22 contributions from other coin magicians that were friends of mine. And that started out only because I felt, you know, my magic is I think pretty general in terms of the style. Like, I think that it's something that most people can use. But I felt that there were other styles that should be showcased in a modern book on coin magic. So I asked a few of my friends like Gallo and Roth and said, can you give me something? And then I was gonna ask some of the other guys from the who appeared on the New York Coin Magic seminar DVDs, like Mark D'Souza, Doug Brewer, I had them contribute something. And there were some people who I didn't know that just it happened to be that we were corresponding time on something, and I asked them to give me something. So, you know, even though I never met Danny Goldsmith, he gave me a routine. And Brendan Wolfe, we were corresponding because of one of his moves using balance palm, which John Bourne actually came up with the name. But I actually had come up with balance palm in the 80s and put it in one of my lecture notes. So I had to let them know that I had done that. Then it's interesting, I found it in a book by Eddie Joseph from the 40s. And so my name was out because he was the originator. And even though those guys did a lot of work on it, he came up with it originally. But I asked them for routines. And so kind of it built up. And some of the people I knew had other projects that they were going to be putting stuff in. So either they had stuff that they couldn't give me because they were using it for their own books, or I just didn't bother them because they I knew that they were doing stuff on, you know, with their own stuff. So so the people, though, are pretty interesting. Got people from, you know, all over the world. And they showcase some very, very interesting techniques. So there are 23 contributions from them, including a contribution from my wife, Karen Doran-Grekia. I won't tell you what it is, but it's very tasty. And you know how DVDs sometimes have those like hidden things in the book? Mm-hmm. If you take a look at that contribution, you might find something else. Just a hint. And then, you know, the puns, I just had a put those in because, again, that's me.
That's so, exactly, that's you, yeah.
I have over 400 puns, not including the ones in my presentations. And I put a lot of my own personal presentations in. I don't expect people to do them exactly the way I do, but I felt that at least they can see how I coordinate the moves with the pattern and, you know, how I use the jokes. I thought that was important. So I put that in as well.
So how can people get one directly from you? Is there an email address or a website or?
No.
Oh, fair enough.
I was going to do all that, and then I just said, you know what, social media is great. So, you know, I kind of put the word out on the Magic Cafe and Facebook, and if people are interested in getting something from me, I do have a limit. I get, every time I make a printing, I get a limited amount of books from the printer. They kind of screwed me over this time, and they only sent me a small amount. So because I had people that were interested, I got a few more from Murphy's. I don't like to bother them. My feeling is just send them all to Murphy's, let them distribute it. You know, I'm fine with that. But I do have a small amount of books that'll be in a week. And if people are interested in getting the book from me, I do sign it. And I do include a free gift, which nobody else does. So I think it's something that really helps. It's something that has to do with the book. I won't say what it is because it may vary depending on availability. But I did give in the past my At the Table DVD. I've given my Penguin Live Lecture DVD, some special coins that you could use for the book. So depending on what I have available, you know, is what comes with the book. But if you want to get it from me and order it from me, you just go to my email address, rubensteindvm@aol.com, and I'll be glad to send you the information. Again, I only have a limited supply, so usually they come in, they go within a week. So if you're interested, you know, now's the time to write me and let me know.
Perfect. Perfect. I've got one last question for you, Mike, to wrap this this whole thing up, which is, what's left on the bucket list? I mean, you've had the career that most people would dream of. You've lectured all over the world. You've released magic tricks. You've created thousands of routines. You've won competitions. You've appeared on TV. You've had the dream career, and it's not even over. Is there anything else that you're wanting to achieve? Or?
Yeah, I want to do card magic. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. I wrote the book. Well, first of all, when I got sick, I really didn't know how long I had. It was a little scary. It was not a cancer, but it kills you just the same. So what's the difference? But I was very lucky. And then I got diagnosed by accident very early before it caused the problem. And as a result, I was able to go under chemo. I had a stem cell transplant, and I'm doing great now. I'm on preventative medicine, but the disease that I have doesn't ever go away, but it's in remission for many years. And by the time it ever starts to show its head, they'll have the other better things. So I'm not really worried, and I'm doing really well. But at the time that all this happened, I thought the book was going to be my swan song. And I remember I had to go in January to the hospital to get a pacemaker. You know, that was kind of a surprise. Didn't expect that. And I made sure that people who could take care of the book for me would, you know, I sent them emails as I'm going to the hospital saying, by the way, here's an update, you know, just in case something happens. But fortunately, everything went well. And so that was going to be the last thing on the bucket list. But fortunately, it's not going to be. I feel that without, you know, having the stress of my former profession, I'm more unencumbered and able to do more magic. And I enjoy magic. It's, for me, it's stress relieving. It's fun. And that's what magic should be. It should be fun. I even say that in my book, you know, you really need to have fun with the material. It's going to school. It's something that you do for your own enjoyment. I think magic makes life better. So I have more time to do that. And who knows if we ever get to see people again. But, you know, I intend to get out there and hopefully travel again once we get that vaccine. And we'll see.
That's fantastic. Michael, it's been a real honor having you on this. This has been wonderful. The advice that you've given, the routines that you've shared, it's been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thank you for being a part of it. Guys, please, I implore you to go. I'll put the email address on the screen. It'll be in the description of the video. Send Michael an email. Do whatever you can do. Beg, borrow, or steal. Get that book. If you want to be a coin magician, it is an absolute must that you own that. We gave it, both me and Ryland gave it 100% on the review show.
Actually, it was 1,000%, but I won't hold you to it.
1,000%, that's right.
But I do want to say that if you guys want to see some of the material, I have a YouTube channel called Rubenstein Coin Magic, and I have a playlist where I put things specifically from the book. And I've been putting up some new things. I just put up some of the techniques that are in chapters 1 and 2, so people can sometimes get a visual of what it looks like. So please take a look at that, just even for your own interest. You know, there are some of the fun routines I've done with presentations, so you can see what they look like. And I hope you enjoy.
What I'll do, as Michael was speaking, there's going to be a card that appears right there at the top of the video. Just click on that and it'll take you straight to Michael's YouTube channel. So you can hit subscribe from there. There you go. Wonders of Modern Technology. And yeah, I've been on that YouTube channel. It's great. You shared a routine from another guy recently who was doing something with a coin and a purse, and it was going in the purse and under the purse. And I was like, wow, this is really good.
Lang from China. He's fantastic. And I actually came across him on Facebook. And I wrote to him and I said, you know, I think your stuff's fantastic. I'd love to have something for my book. And he was generous enough to show me 3 routines. 2 of them used gaff coins. And I felt that since my book was primarily sleight of hand, I wanted that. And I only, you know, I have a few routines. Like I just showed you a basic part of a longer routine that's in the book. The longer routine is actually on my YouTube channel. But he gave me a purse routine, which is fantastic, where 4 coins from an empty purse are produced. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful routine. One of many that, you know, some of these guys contributed. I really appreciate their efforts in giving me those things. Yeah, if you get a chance, go see him work. He's great. And you'll read about it in the book.
Yeah, it's in the book. He's on the YouTube channel. Go check it out and subscribe to Michael's channel while you're at it, because it is some amazing coin stuff that goes up there. Michael, thank you so much. Guys, don't forget, subscribe to the channel. I'm going to be back tomorrow with another review show with Rye. So I'll see you back tomorrow. And thanks very much for watching. Take care, everyone. Bye.